In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Disclaimer. The story you're about to read is based on the text, The House That Cries in the Night, found in True Philippine Ghost Stories, Book 1, authored by Anonymous, pages 68 to 71. This expanded version seeks to illuminate cultural, historical, and thematic elements. No copyright infringement is intended, and full intellectual property rights belong to the original author and publisher. The following is a companion piece presented with due respect for the original source. The sea has a language all its own. On the western coast of Batangas, a province in the southwestern stretch of Luzon in the Philippines, the waves brush softly against the sands at twilight. It's a gentle push and pull that many find comforting, a lullaby of foam and brine. In the town of Nasugbu, this nightly conversation between sea and shore has lulled generations of families to sleep, caressed by a breeze that carries both the tang of salt and the hum of inherited stories. Nasugbu, often known for its dive spots and beaches, is a place that can seem deceptively tranquil. Tourists come for the sun, sand, and crystal clear waters. They see children laughing as they chase each other on the beach, fishermen tending their nets at dawn, and families savoring the catch of the day under thatched nipper huts. They see postcards come to life, a slice of paradise where life moves a little slower and the traffic jams of Manila feel worlds away. But the night is a realm of secrets. When darkness falls and the moon gleams off the water, stories slip out like half-remembered dreams. In the Philippines, and indeed in many parts of the world, rumors of hauntings and curses meander from household to household. They flit between gossiping neighbors, swirl in the steam rising from a street vendor's pot of arroz caldo, and sometimes settle upon the threshold of a specific home. A house where something tragic transpired. Tragedy, after all, has a long memory. What if a home becomes more than just wood and stone? More than just a roof and walls? What if it becomes a receptacle of suffering, echoing with the cries of those long gone? Tonight, we step foot into such a place. A house that neither sunlight nor cheerful company could banish from the gloom cast by its history. Locals call it the house that cries in the night. Some have heard its sobs in the small hours before dawn, when the rest of the world is asleep. Some swear they've heard something else, too. A plea. A final gasp for help that continues to echo. In this retelling, we will journey through time, place, and memory to uncover how tragedy seeped into the walls of this modest home. We will follow the chain of events that led to a double murder, an unresolved quest for justice, and restless spirits that refused to bow to silence. We will hear from neighbors who tried to forget what they knew, from new occupants who discovered that the past is rarely buried, and from the inexorable tide of history itself, which can wash over any attempt at normalcy like an unstoppable wave. This is episode 13. The House That Cries in the Night. A companion story to the anonymous account found in True Philippine Ghost Stories, Book 1. I am Mark, and I invite you to walk these haunted corridors with me. If you listen closely, you might still catch the faint sound of weeping carried on the breeze. And in that moment, you too might feel the chill of a justice unfulfilled. Nasugbu is known for its restful atmosphere, a place of palm-fringed coves and bright beach umbrellas. But behind the layers of sea breeze and coconut trees, this town has stories that have been passed down from generation to generation. Some revolve around Spanish-era ghostly friars, rumored to wander the old paths of the province. Others describe Aswang sightings in the deeper barrios, told primarily as cautionary tales for children who might stray too far after dark. Still, other stories revolve around tragic accidents at sea, the ghosts of drowned fisherfolk who appear during storms to warn their living counterparts of hidden reefs and rocky shoals. In these stories, the line between the mundane and the supernatural is permeable. The living and the dead coexist in the Filipino imagination in a way that feels deeply organic. Houses, especially older ones, often become central characters in these narratives. They can be imposing structures that have witnessed centuries of family history, or humble bungalows battered by monsoons that may harbor secrets far weightier than their modest architecture suggests. The Philippines is a tapestry of faiths and folklore, pre-colonial animistic beliefs, woven with centuries of Catholic tradition and echoes of Chinese and Malay influences, form a unique spiritual landscape. People pray at Mass, but also consult local healers for health and well-being. Family elders speak of white ladies by the roadside, while teenagers share stories of capere sightings, or duendes living under the kitchen sink. It's a cultural mosaic that acknowledges the supernatural without flinching. In small towns like Nasugbu, it's not unusual to find the faithful in church on Sundays, lighting candles for those who have passed, and then, on a dark night, leaving offerings of rice and salt by a balite tree to appease wandering spirits. The old merges with the new in curious ways, and ghost stories become moral reminders to the community. Don't cheat your neighbor. Don't disrespect the dead. Don't leave injustices unresolved. In the house that becomes our focus, these cultural threads tighten like a noose around a tragedy. When heartbreak is coupled with betrayal and a sense of injustice, the spiritual realm is often stirred. Hindi pa sila matahimik, say the elders. They're not at peace yet. Imagine a modest single-story home, built of sturdy cement walls, with a red-tiled roof that's seen countless rainy seasons. Wind chimes hang by the window, their tinkling mingling with the rustling of banana leaves out back. The yard is neither large nor small. It's enough space for a papaya tree, or two, a patch of herbs, and a bamboo bench where one can sip morning coffee. This is where Marita, a diligent housewife in her early 40s, lived. Marita was the heart of her family. She had a warm, empathetic smile and the capacity to welcome guests with open arms. She was the type of neighbor who would bring over a platter of freshly fried lumpia during fiestas, or help babysit the children next door while their parents ran errands in town. Life in a place like Nasugbu is communal. People look out for one another, celebrating birthdays with the fervor of fiestas, and mourning losses as though each belonged to every household. Her husband Tony was physically absent for much of the year. Like countless overseas Filipino workers, Tony had found a job abroad, in Saudi Arabia specifically, lured by the promise of higher wages. A challenging but often necessary choice, working overseas could help a family in the Philippines afford a better life, renovations for the children, or a small business to secure a more stable future. Every few months, Tony would come back to Nasugbu for a vacation, or to spend holidays with Marita and their daughter. Their daughter Jennifer was 18, right on the cusp of adulthood. She had just finished high school, a transitional period, brimming with possibilities. Jennifer dreamt of maybe becoming a nurse or a teacher, professions that, while challenging, also carried the promise of upward mobility. Her father's sacrifices overseas motivated her. She wanted to succeed, to repay him for all those years he'd spent sweating in a foreign land. Jennifer had inherited her mother's kindness and her father's determination. She volunteered at the local church collecting clothes for donation drives. In many ways, she was the soul of the household, bridging the gap between her mother's gentle warmth and her father's distant sense of duty. One neighbor recalled that Jennifer would often greet people in the street, offering a sunny, "Good morning." That was the last memory they had of her. A bright smile, a wave, a promise of tomorrow. Tarazón had been a friend of the family, close enough that many in the neighborhood simply accepted her presence in the house. A lesbian woman in her 30s, Tarazón exuded a certain confidence, wearing short hair and preferring men's t-shirts. Her orientation wasn't a secret, but in the fairly conservative town, it was seldom discussed openly. Marita, being the open-hearted soul she was, cared little for the gossips. But the moment she flashed her beautiful pouch, a large bolt of light, she welcomed Corazon into her home, sometimes letting her spend weekends there if she needed a break from her own troubled household situation. There were rumors, though. A few neighbors, always quick to read more into a situation than is warranted, wondered if Corazon harbored unspoken feelings for Marita. Or maybe even Jennifer. It was pure speculation, whispered behind the battered shutters of local sari-sari stores where older women traded rumors like currency. Most shrugged off the talk. It was more likely, they said, that Corazon was simply a close friend, someone who found acceptance in this family and no place else. Before that fateful night, life in this house was unremarkable in its day-to-day pattern. Marita would wake before dawn, brew barico coffee grown in a nearby plantation, and prepare a simple breakfast of rice and tuyo for Jennifer. Mother and daughter would sometimes share quiet moments in the morning, listening to the chirping of birds or planning the day ahead. Around mid-morning, Jennifer might head off to meet friends or run errands. But Marita would tidy the house, maybe wash laundry by hand in the backyard, humming to herself as the sun rose higher. Corazón would drop by occasionally. Sometimes she brought groceries or shared stories of her own job as a store clerk in the neighboring municipality. Occasionally Tony would call from overseas. Jennifer, excited, would ask him how life was abroad, were there places to see, what was the food like. Tony would answer with typical paternal caution, focusing on the dryness of the weather and the long hours of work. He spoke little about anything else. Money was the real reason for his being there, and family was the real reason he endured it. No one in Nasagbu could have predicted how quickly this calm would unravel. The year was 1999, and the summer was unusually hot. The sun bore down on Nasagbu with an almost relentless fervor, turning midday streets into shimmering mirages of heat. People stayed indoors around noon, fans whirred, and children found refuge under trees or in the shade of tall fences. The season was the talk of the town. "It's so hot," they said, as if the scorched air was the only thing worth discussing. The dryness also brought an uneasy stillness at night. No cool breeze, no drizzling rain to break the monotony. Darkness settled like a dense veil, encouraging early bedtimes. In a neighborhood like this, the hush of midnight was typically unbroken, save for the occasional bark of a dog or the rare rumble of a passing tricycle. It happened quickly, with the stealth of a predator. There were two gunshots, or so the investigations would later suggest, Some said they heard faint pops, like fireworks exploding in the distance, but dismissed them because it wasn't fiesta season. A few neighbors mentioned hearing a dog barking incessantly, but at that ungodly hour, most people were too groggy to investigate. The next morning would bring the truth to light. Marita and Jennifer, the bedrocks of this home, were found dead. Police found them in the living room, both shot at close range. Although the authorities tried to keep the more graphic details under wraps, word got out in a small community. One of the responding officers whispered that the look on Jennifer's face, frozen in horror, was something he would carry to his grave. Both mother and daughter had died quickly, though not instantly, the investigators deduced. Marita's hand was clasped around Jennifer's in a final gesture of futile protection. Corazon vanished that night. She was gone by dawn, leaving behind scant evidence other than a known friendship with the victims. Whispers spread rapidly. Had Corazon been the killer? Many pinned the blame on her, citing a possible romantic obsession or a dispute over money. The latter became the prevailing narrative. Documents indicated that Corazon had borrowed money from Marita, a sum she had difficulty repaying. Perhaps the tension over debt escalated into confrontation, culminating in murder. Local law enforcement and the community held their breath. Tony, half a world away, received the call in the early hours of his shift. The news shattered him. Torn by rage and grief, he left everything behind and flew back to the Philippines. At Manila's Ninoy Aquino International Airport, Tony's expression shifted soon after the ship landed. Cast out of influence, late at night, escorted by relatives who tried to shield him from the heartbreak that lay ahead. Funeral rites in the Philippines are a solemn affair, even more so in a small town. White flowers, black armbands and flickering candles accompanied Marita and Jennifer's final journey. The local parish held a service, the priest's words echoing in the old stone church. The community came together, each person offering what comfort they could. But comfort is small consolation to a father who has lost not just one, but two reasons for living. As in the ensuing investigation, the police discovered that certain sums of money were indeed missing from the family's accounts. Corazon became the prime suspect, but she was nowhere to be found. She had left no trace behind except for rumor and speculation. Some local folks claimed they saw her board a bus out of Batangas, headed north. Others speculated she had hopped on a boat to the Visayas, or even fled to Mindanao. The labyrinth of the archipelago could swallow her whole if she chose to hide. Tony offered a reward from his own savings. He was willing to spend everything to see justice served. For months, the search continued. Law enforcers posted her photo in bus terminals, ports, and public markets. Bounty hunters made inquiries. Friends of Tony scoured far-flung barangays. Then, one day, a tip arrived. Corazon had been spotted in a dilapidated boarding house living under a false name. Which, whether it was guilt, necessity, or desperation that had guided her, no one could say. The trial was swift by local standards. Swifter than usual, anyway, though it still took nearly a year. Testimony upon testimony built a case that Corazon had indeed been at odds with Marita over money. She was found guilty and sentenced to life imprisonment. The local radio station reported the news. "Justice has been served," they said. But the Philippines is known for a legal system that can be labyrinthine, marked by appeals and complexities. After some months in prison, Corazon's lawyer found a loophole, a missing document, a procedural oversight, some detail that had been overlooked. The conviction was overturned, and Corazon walked free. It was as though the heavens themselves had wept. The entire community reeled in shock. Tony, disillusioned, sold the house and left. Where he went, nobody quite knew. Some said he returned overseas. Others believed he retreated to a remote province to live out his life in sorrow. And the house that had been a testament to love and hope became a husk, standing vacant for years under the punishing sun. Paint peeled from the walls, weeds grew unchecked, and the windows looked like silent eyes witnessing a secret they dared not reveal. 4 years passed before a new family dared to move into the property. The Martinezes, Reuben, his wife Celia, their teen children, Joseph and Eliza, had just returned from Manila, longing for a quieter, more affordable life. This house was priced intriguingly low. The real estate agent, with aforesaid laughter, lost over its history. "It needs a little renovation," he said, conveniently omitting the tragedies that once befell it. The Martinezes, like so many others seeking a fresh start, took the bait. On moving day, the family's old jeepney rattled into the driveway, loaded with furniture, boxes, and a battered upright piano that had belonged to Celia's grandmother. The place certainly looked ordinary enough. An average-sized front yard, a robust fence, and pastel-colored walls that had clearly seen better days. There was a slight sag in the roof, but that was fixable. The interior smelled musty from disuse. Sunlight filtered through dusty windows, revealing floorboards that creaked with each footstep. At first, life went on like any new chapter, unpacking boxes, rearranging furniture, and getting used to the new environment. Joseph found a local basketball court where he could shoot hoops with newfound friends. Eliza enrolled at the local public high school, determined to blend in. Reuben busied himself with plans to patch the roof and repaint the walls. Celia, who had a talent for interior design, brainstormed ways to liven up the space. All seemed fine, until nighttime. The Martinez family soon discovered that the stillness of the night wasn't always peaceful. Celia would stir in her sleep, hearing faint sobs that came and went, like the flicker of a candle flame. Joseph heard footsteps in the hallway, and once or twice, he stepped out of his room to confront what he believed was a prowler, only to find darkness. Eliza sometimes felt a cold draft, even with all the windows shut. She would shiver, though the summer air remained muggy and oppressive. They brushed these experiences aside, attributing them to the stress of moving and the unfamiliar environment. But the incidents grew more frequent, more insistent. One night, Joseph awoke to the sound of a woman's voice, a desperate whisper, calling out, "Sakolo, too long, please help me." He bolted upright, heart thudding. Gathering his courage, he investigated every corner of the house, but found no one. Neighbors rarely visited. Some offered polite waves from across the street, but most seemed uneasy. A few gave the Martinez home a wide berth, almost as though it were diseased. Eventually, Eliza managed to befriend a local girl named Aka, who'd confided in hushed tones that the house had a dreadful past. "It's rumored to be haunted," she told Eliza. "Terrible things happened there." Eliza brought this up with her parents, who were skeptical. Reuben was a pragmatic man, not given to superstition. Celia, although deeply Catholic, felt certain that if any spirits lingered, a simple blessing by a priest would banish them. Nonetheless, the family hesitated to do anything about it. Perhaps it was denial, or a reluctance to confirm the rumors. They had sunk their savings into this place. To uproot themselves again would be a financial nightmare. Then came the night of the first truly unmistakable event. It was around 3 a.m., the hour some called the witching hour, though Filipinos often referred to it simply as the Oras Multo, ghost hour. The entire Martinez household awoke to a piercing sob. It sounded like two voices at once, one older, one younger. The sound echoed through the corridors, ricocheting off the very walls. Reuben and Celia scrambled out of bed, hearts racing. Joseph and Eliza rushed out of their rooms. But no intruder was found. No signs of forced entry. No vehicles outside. Only the still, dark sky. When they turned the lights on, the living room seemed unremarkable, as if it hadn't just been the epicenter of a soul-wrenching cry. Yet the air felt charged, almost electric. Celia swore she heard sobbing fade to whimpers before vanishing altogether. After that night, the family could no longer hide from the strange reality closing in around them. Their previously comfortable new home had become a place where restless spirits seemed determined to make themselves known. Reuben tried to rationalize the situation. Old pipes, acoustical anomalies, perhaps even wild animals outside. But Celia's maternal instinct sensed more. She lit candles, recited prayers, and sprinkled holy water around each room, muttering pleas for peace and protection. Joseph, who had always been fearless, felt a new kind of dread gnaw at him. He tried to confide in friends at school, only to be met with awkward silences or nervous laughter. Nobody wanted to discuss the house in any concrete detail, though a few whispered, "Death happened there." Meanwhile, Eliza took a more direct approach. She decided to research the home's history. First by asking around, then by visiting the local parish archives. What she uncovered would confirm her worst suspicions and thrust her family into a confrontation with a past drenched in blood. In a town as small as Nasugbu, the past rarely remains buried if you know which questions to ask. Eliza visited the parish priest, Father Gerardo, who had been serving the community since the mid-1980s. She asked him about the house and whether he had records or recollections of any tragic events that had occurred there. The old priest's face grew solemn. He spoke in low tones, his voice trembling slightly as he remembered officiating a funeral mass for two women who had died under appalling circumstances. "She was a dear woman," he said, referring to Marita and her daughter Jennifer. "So young." His gaze fell to the floor as if he were staring at the ghosts of that memory. "They were murdered. It was a terrible time for the entire community. The father was abroad, so you can imagine he was beside himself with grief." After talking to the priest, Eliza poked around the neighborhood. She learned that many people had lived in the area long enough to remember the murders vividly, yet nearly all of them clammed up when pressed for details. Some cowered at the mere mention of Corazon's name, as if speaking it aloud would summon her. A few grew visibly uneasy, their eyes darting around to ensure no one overheard them. The local pan de sal vendor, an elderly woman named Alignati, admitted she had been haunted by nightmares after the crime. "My dreams," she said. "I saw the mother and daughter crying out for justice." Little by little, the pieces of the puzzle fell into place. By the time Eliza finished her informal investigation, she felt the weight of the house's history bearing down on her. It was more than a random tragedy. It was a betrayal, a break in the natural order of trust and friendship. No wonder the house seemed stained with sorrow. Armed with information, Eliza returned home and gathered her family in the living room. She recounted everything she had discovered: the murders, the suspect named Corazon, the trial, and the ultimate legal loophole that allowed the killer to go free. As she spoke, Celia covered her mouth in horror, Reuben clenched his fists, outraged that neither the real estate agent nor the neighbors had warned them properly. Joseph looked both scared and determined, as if prepared to defend his family by any means necessary. The next question was obvious. What to do now? Move out and risk financial ruin? Stay and try to cohabit with lingering spirits? Or attempt something bolder, like seeking to appease or help those spirits find peace? Celia, who held strong Catholic convictions, contacted the diocese to request a house blessing. Father Gerardo himself showed up a few days later, decked in his vestments, carrying holy water and a Bible. The family followed him from room to room, reciting prayers. Flickers of candlelight danced on the walls as he sprinkled water on the floors and in the corners, asking for God's protection and the repose of any wandering souls. For a brief time, the house felt lighter, as though a fresh breeze had swept through it. The family slept soundly that night, perhaps for the first time in weeks. But like a storm that dissipates only to return with renewed force, the haunting resumed a few days later. The voices, the sobs, the flickering lights, all intensified, as if spurred by the attempted blessing. While some families might have panicked and fled, the Martinez household drew closer together in unity. Reuben, typically stoic, pledged to remain steadfast. Celia doubled her prayers, kneeling by the small altar she had set up in the living room each morning. Joseph, struggling to balance teen life with the growing sense of dread, but nights were still fraught with tension. Joseph garroted, fell out of bed with me every night, thinking of Julia the whole time she went away. Joseph couldn't stand the girls. They made him laugh. Eliza, whose curiosity had sparked this deeper investigation, became more convinced than ever that the spirits of Marita and Jennifer were trapped, unable to move on because the real killer walked free. She began to wonder if these spirits wanted more than a prayer. Perhaps they needed the story to be heard once more, or new evidence to surface. Perhaps they needed an acknowledgement from the community. With each passing day, Eliza felt an inexplicable pull, as though she were being guided by an unseen hand. It started one morning at around 4:30 a.m. Joseph had stayed up late studying for an exam. He was half asleep, his notes still spread across the desk, when he heard footsteps in the hallway. Slow, deliberate, like someone pacing. He glanced at the clock. "Dad?" he murmured. Stepping out of his room, the hallway light was off, but faint illumination from a nearby street lamp filtered through the window. No silhouette, no shadow. Yet, the footsteps continued, circling the corridor as if searching for something. Joseph's heart pounded so fiercely he thought his chest might burst. Gathering courage, he called out again. "Who's there?" No answer. The footsteps simply stopped. Silence enveloped the space, thick and suffocating. Joseph checked the entire house, only to find his family asleep in their rooms. Another incident came one humid afternoon when Celia was folding laundry in the living room. She heard a soft moan emanating from the walls themselves, like someone exhaling a deep, pained breath. The moan turned into muffled weeping, so quiet it was almost imperceptible. Yet Celia felt the vibration in her bones. She stood there, paralyzed, as though the house were literally weeping. After a few moments, the sound faded, leaving an eerie stillness behind. Celia later described the sensation as feeling like a heartbreak that never ended. Electric disturbances abounded, especially in the late evenings when the family gathered for dinner. On multiple occasions, the overhead lights would dim and brighten erratically, as though controlled by a hidden switch. An electrician came twice but found no faults. He replaced the bulbs, checked the wiring, and left with a shrug. Even with the brand new fixtures, the flickering persisted. Unsudden, unpredictable, like a coded signal in Morse. Eliza, the most intrepid of them all, began having dreams. Lucid, disquieting visions where she wandered the house at night in search of something. In these dreams, she'd see a faint figure of a woman near a window, her face partly obscured by shadows. The figure would weep, blood staining the front of her dress. Eliza would call out, "Who are you?" The woman never replied. Instead, she lifted her hand to point at the front door. When Eliza shared this dream with Father Gerardo, he offered a cautious interpretation. "Perhaps she's trying to show you the path to resolution. The door might symbolize an entryway to truth, or a reminder that the killer walked freely through it. Sometimes we see in dreams what our waking minds cannot bear to confront." One evening, as the family assembled for a quiet meal of adobo and rice, Eliza felt something brush against her arm. She looked down, half expecting to see a stray insect or maybe the cat from next door. But there was nothing there. Yet the contact had been distinctly human. Fingers grazing her skin, a chill rippled through her, enough to make her gasp. She glanced around the room. No one seemed to have noticed. Such was the nature of their life now, a mix of everyday normalcy and creeping unease. Where most families would focus on chores, work, and homework, the Martinezes found themselves planning how to deal with poltergeist-like apparitions, spectral crying, and intangible presences that ghosted through their daily routines. Hauntings often tie themselves to specific spaces, replaying the darkest moments like a broken record. In the living room, where Marita and Jennifer had been found, Eliza noticed that the temperature often dropped abruptly, even in the intense midday heat. Joseph once tried to test this phenomenon with a digital thermometer. Indeed, the device showed a sudden 10-degree drop in a spot near the sofa, then reverted to normal a few feet away. The phenomenon intrigued Eliza. She recalled how the women's bodies were discovered near that very sofa. Could this be where their anguish was most concentrated? The family had never felt threatened, per se. More so suffocated by an overpowering sadness. Eliza felt that sadness was the unspoken message. We're still here, broken and unhealed. On multiple nights, a dog's distant barking would echo through the neighborhood. This wasn't surprising on its own. Dogs bark frequently. But the neighbor's dogs, including the one right next door, never seemed to match the phantom barks in time or intensity. One late night, Joseph and Eliza ventured outside, following the sound to the edge of the property. There, at the fence, they thought they saw the silhouette of a dog pacing restlessly. Its eyes glinted in the moonlight, but when they drew closer, nothing was there. Later, in conversation with an elderly neighbor, they learned that on the night of the murders, a dog had barked incessantly. "It barked as if it was warning us of something," the neighbor had said. "But we didn't listen. We just slept on." Determined to glean more clues, Eliza made another trip, this time to see a local historian who kept a small archive of newspapers and photographs. She hoped to find coverage of the murder. Sure enough, an old local newspaper had published an article titled "Mother and Daughter Murder Shocks Nasugubu." The grainy black and white photograph featured a younger Tony standing outside the home, his face etched in despair. There was a second photo. The living room, cordoned off with police tape. Though poorly printed, it showed dark stains on the floor where the bodies had been found. The article emphasized money as the motive and mentioned Corazon's name, but only briefly. A chilling detail. The day Marita and Jennifer died, the local power supply had been unusually stable, meaning no known outages could have masked the gunshots. Yet nobody reported hearing them. Only the dog had raised an alarm. It seemed the entire neighborhood had collectively slept through the murder. Pear, word of the Martinez family's haunted experiences eventually reached a small group of paranormal enthusiasts who occasionally traveled through Batangas. They included a self-described psychic medium named Marjorie, who claimed she could communicate with restless spirits through prayer and concentration. Marjorie offered to visit the house, eager to test her abilities. With both hope and trepidation, the family agreed. Marjorie arrived one late afternoon with two associates. Armed with crystals, incense, and a digital recorder, she walked through the living room, the hallway, and the bedrooms. She asked for silence and then closed her eyes, murmuring incantations.
You can't rely on blind faith to get the pregnancy support you deserve. Ritual's essential prenatal multivitamin is the only leading prenatal backed by its own human clinical trial. Essential Prenatal is proven to deliver key nutrients, including folate, biotin, and vitamin D during pregnancy. Get 25% off when you visit ritual.com/clinical. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
After a few minutes, she shuddered. "So much sorrow," she whispered. "They are here. Two of them, bound by anger, heartbreak, and a demand for justice." Her eyes snapped open, tears streaming down her cheeks. "They say the killer isn't truly condemned. Aye, they cry out for the truth to be heard. Though it's more than truth. They need recognition. They want the world to know they are more than just victims." Her associates recorded temperature drops, but no definitive photographic evidence emerged. Still, their presence felt validating to the family. Perhaps the spirits truly sought a final resolution. What became increasingly obvious was that an undercurrent of communal guilt ran through the neighborhood. Many people had known Marita and Jennifer. Many had heard the barking dog and done nothing. And perhaps more people than anyone realized knew about Corazon's crimes, yet refused to step forward to ensure her conviction stuck. Whatever their individual reasons, fear, indifference, or a flawed justice system, they seemed collectively bound to this unspoken shame. Rumors persisted that Corazon had found a new life in some distant province or overseas, free from the shadow of her deeds. Some whispered that she had remarried, adopting a straight persona to avoid suspicion. Others said she died alone in a freak accident, haunted by the spirits she had wronged. No confirmation existed. Like a specter herself, Corazon flitted in and out of the town's memory, leaving a trail of uneasy nightmares. The question loomed: why did the ghosts choose to manifest now, so vividly, after the house had stood vacant for years? One might argue that the presence of a new family provided fresh energy, fresh life, to awaken them. Another explanation was that the current cultural climate, with the rise of true crime stories and more open discussions about unsolved mysteries, created a space for these spirits to be heard. Either way, their spectral lamentation grew more intense, as though the weight of unaddressed injustice pressed on them. Within the Martinez family, opinions diverged on how to proceed. Reuben was tired exhausted from the stress of living in a haunted environment. He felt morally obligated to help, but also recognized that nothing he did would bring Marita and Jennifer back. Celia, meanwhile, believed in the power of prayer. Night after night, she lit candles for the departed souls, hoping that her devotion could ease their suffering. Gustav was angry at the ghosts for invading his home, at Carason for her alleged crime, and at the community for keeping silent. Eliza, though frightened, felt an inexplicable kinship with the spirits. She could almost sense their hope and despair intermingling, like two streams of water flowing in opposite directions. In an effort to find some way to lay the ghosts to rest, Eliza requested access to municipal records from 1999. Buried among property documents and old police reports, she located a file that detailed Corazon's initial arrest, her conviction, and the subsequent overturning of that conviction. There were extensive notes from the defense, referencing, for instance, first, an improperly handled chain of custody for certain forensic materials. Technicalities, yes, but enough to topple the guilty verdict. Yet something else in the files caught Eliza's eye. Testimonies that suggested Corazon might not have acted alone. The statements were unsigned, no doubt from anonymous sources who feared retaliation. They hinted that the murder might have involved more than just a dispute over borrowed money. One line read, "Tony had an insurance policy. Big payout." Another stated, "Corazon told me she was threatened by someone else. Someone bigger." Could it be that the story had layers beyond the immediate suspect? Had the community pinned everything on Corazon because it was simpler to blame one scapegoat? Eliza pored over these details in disbelief, feeling as though the tragedy was more complex than the official narrative suggested. Yet nobody in town seemed eager to revisit the matter, and Tony was long gone. Deeply disturbed, Eliza sought out Father Gerardo once more. She showed him copies of the documents and asked if he'd ever heard rumors of a larger conspiracy. The priest hesitated, torn between the confessional seal and his sense of moral duty. "I do recall hearing something about Tony's insurance, but it was never confirmed, and as for an accomplice, rumors spread easily. One must tread carefully, especially when the line between truth and speculation is so thin." Even so, Father Gerardo admitted that he believed the haunting could stem from that unresolved dimension. If the real nature of the crime remained hidden, Marita and Jennifer might be crying out for the complete truth, not merely a partial confession. Eliza presented her findings to the rest of the family. Reuben, who had initially resisted getting too involved, now saw that perhaps the only way to bring peace to their home was to dive headlong into the murky waters of the past. Celia, while still believing in spiritual healing through prayer, recognized that material justice might also be necessary. Joseph, for his part, experienced a surprising surge of empathy for Marita and Jennifer. "We didn't deserve this. We can't ignore them anymore," he said, choking back tears. They decided to try and contact Tony, hoping he might shed light on these rumors. Reuben still had connections in Manila from his younger days. He would try to find any thread leading to Tony's whereabouts. Eliza would continue scouring the archives for more clues. In the meantime, the entire family pledged to be more open and direct with the spirits. If they heard sobbing, they would gently speak words of reassurance. If they felt the presence, they would say, "We are here to help." Many would call this approach unorthodox, even foolhardy. But when living in a place that houses restless spirits, sometimes the line between the living and dead blurs to a point where direct communication seems the only course of action. Through a contact in Manila, Reuben learned that Tony had a relative working in Cavite. It took weeks of phone calls and dead ends, but eventually Tony's phone number was obtained. With trembling hands, Reuben dialed the number, A weary voice answered. It was Tony indeed. At first, Tony was reluctant to talk. He had buried the past, or so he believed. The mention of the murders broke something in his voice. He confessed he had never truly moved on. How could he? He asked why the Martinez family was digging up old wounds. Isn't it enough that she's gone free? What more can we do? He lamented. Reuben explained about the hauntings, the sobs at night, and the cryptic rumors of an unspoken element in the crime. After a long pause, Tony sighed. I knew about the insurance rumors, but they were untrue. I had a life insurance policy, yes, but Marita was never the beneficiary. That was all nonsense. As for an accomplice, I can't say. The only possibility is that Corazon might have known someone in the justice system. Money can do dark miracles. He thanked them for caring about the souls of his wife and daughter. Yet Tony's despair was palpable. He seemed paralyzed by grief and resignation, unwilling to partake in any new crusade for justice. I have no power to change the past. Please let them rest, he said before ending the call. The conversation left the Martinez family in a swirl of conflicting emotions. Tony provided no fresh leads, only a glimpse into the bottomless well of his sorrow. Yet their resolve remained firm. At this point, they sensed that the ghosts wanted not just legal resolution, but a deeper acknowledgement from the community that had turned a blind eye. The family turned inward, deciding to approach the matter through the lens of local customs for honoring the dead. In Filipino culture, when a loved one passes, it's common to hold nightly prayers or novenas, leading up to the ninth day after the death, or sometimes up to the 40th day. The idea is to help guide the soul toward peace. The Martinez family decided to hold a series of prayers for Marita and Jennifer, inviting neighbors to join. They set up an altar with pictures of Jesus, Mary, and the saints, adding two white candles, one representing Marita, one for Jennifer. On the first night of the novena, only a handful of neighbors came, drawn more by curiosity than empathy. Still, the prayers were solemn, punctuated by the flicker of candlelight. The air felt heavy, but not malevolent. A presence loomed, as though the spirits hovered on the periphery, listening. Word spread. By the third night, more neighbors turned up. Some brought food, pancit, empanadas, putor, and placed them on the table as an offering. Even those who had been reluctant to talk began to trickle in, compelled by a sense that perhaps, after all these years, it was time to face the old wounds. The sobs continued to haunt the nights, but they now felt more like sorrowful acceptance than anguished demands. On the fifth night, a neighbor tearfully confessed how she had heard the gunshots, but had been too terrified to speak up. Another neighbor, an older man, admitted he had seen Corazon leaving the house, but told no one, fearing retribution. Each confession seemed to soothe the intangible tension clinging to the walls. During these novena nights, Celia led prayers not just for the repose of Marita and Jennifer, but for justice. She asked for the community to find peace within themselves, to release the guilt of inaction, and to vow never to ignore cries for help again. A hush always fell over the group when she uttered these words, as though they recognized the moral failing and the opportunity for redemption. By the seventh night, something changed. The lights no longer flickered. The moaning in the walls subsided. Even the footsteps at dawn softened. It was as if the house itself was exhaling a long-held breath, relieved to be unburdened of secrets. On the eighth night of the novena, multiple neighbors reported having the same dream. In it, Marita and Jennifer stood outside the house in simple dresses, bathed in a warm, gentle light. Their faces were no longer contorted by fear. Instead, they appeared calm. Some dreamers said the mother and daughter uttered a quiet, "Salamats." Thank you. Others claimed the pair nodded in gratitude before walking away into a radiant horizon. A quiet sense of awe spread through the community. Had the souls at last found a sliver of peace? Yet, for Eliza, the dream was slightly different. In her vision, Jennifer handed her a small piece of paper, blank except for a single word scrawled in red. Truth. When Eliza awoke, she felt an urgency that she hadn't felt before. The novena might have brought the spirits closer to tranquility, but they still yearned for more. Some kind of final revelation or acknowledgement from those responsible. Another visitor, Eliza worked with St. Isaac's to limit. Maybe it was a confession from Corazon, or an official statement from the judicial system. Something remained undone. Fearing that without this final piece, the haunting might intensify again, Eliza and her family decided to consult an attorney to see if the case could be reopened. It was a long shot, given how much time had passed, but they reasoned that if Corazon, or anyone else involved, was still alive, fresh evidence or testimonies could be the key to a genuine justice. Fearing that without this Corazon, or anyone else involved, was still alive, fresh evidence or testimonies could be the key to genuine justice. Reuben, Celia, and Eliza visited a lawyer in the Batanga City Hall. The attorney listened patiently, eyebrows raised. He noted that the case was complicated by the overturned conviction, meaning double jeopardy might apply. Without new and compelling evidence, the courts were unlikely to reconsider the case. The lawyer offered a sympathetic smile, acknowledging the tragedy, but also expressed doubt that the system would produce any remedy at this juncture. The family left with heavy hearts. Their attempt at legal recourse had hit the predictable snag: bureaucracy and the passage of time. For a moment, despair threatened to overwhelm them. If the legal route was closed, how could they fulfill the spirit's final plea? Then Eliza had a realization. If the official channels wouldn't help, perhaps public exposure might. She could compile the whole account, both the murders and the haunting, and share it widely, ensuring that the memory of Marita and Jennifer would not be forgotten. She believed that sometimes shining a spotlight on injustices could provoke a moral response from the public. We may not convict Corazon again, she thought, but at least we can honor the victims by keeping the story alive. Eliza began drafting a comprehensive document of everything she had learned and experienced, referencing old articles, testimonies from neighbors, and details of the haunting. Two, she aimed to submit this to local journalists or perhaps post it online. In doing so, she hoped to create a living record of the truth, an enduring testament that might, in some small measure, bring solace to the spirits. As word of Eliza's effort to compile a dossier on the murders circulated, a handful of local historians and true crime enthusiasts reached out to her. They offered to help gather data, interview witnesses, and even translate documents into English so they could be shared more widely. It was a grassroots movement, spurred by curiosity and compassion. This collective synergy renewed Eliza's hope. While some in the town remained wary, an undercurrent of relief spread through the neighborhood. People began to speak more openly about that tragic summer in 1999. For the first time, many admitted they had harbored guilt and nightmares. Now they found a communal way to process it all, through storytelling, writing, and a shared desire to atone for the past. It was a slow process, but each conversation served as a tiny patch on the large tear in the town's moral fabric. Meanwhile, Celia continued her prayers, inviting Father Gerardo occasionally. Together they would light candles for Marita and Jennifer, calling upon the saints to intercede. Each time the house felt calmer, as though a gentle hush blanketed the once tumultuous spiritual atmosphere. Joseph, who once harbored anger, found its easing into compassion. He even took up journaling, writing short reflections on how the entire ordeal had changed his perspective on life and responsibility. One remarkable shift occurred toward the end of the novena. The haunting quieted. Where once the walls wept and disembodied footsteps roamed, the house now stood mostly silent. Even the dog's phantom bark had ceased. Some interpreted this as a sign that the spirits were finally moving on, or at least finding temporary solace. Others feared it was a calm before another storm. Yet the silence did not mean the spirits were entirely gone. One particular night, Eliza heard a gentle tapping on her bedroom window, a sound reminiscent of fingernails lightly rapping on glass. She mustered the courage to look, half expecting a stray tree branch. Instead, she witnessed a faint glow, a soft luminescence in the shape of a figure. She couldn't discern facial features, but the energy felt gentle, almost grateful. There was no voice, just the sense of presence. Eliza closed her eyes and quietly said, "We remember you. We're trying. Please be patient with us." When she opened her eyes again, the glow had vanished. She felt an inexplicable sense of peace wash over her, as though the spirit acknowledged her words. In the living room, the Martinis family had previously placed a rug over the area where Marita and Jennifer's bodies were discovered. One afternoon, Celia decided to roll up the rug for a thorough cleaning. To her astonishment, she found faint but visible marks on the wooden floor, almost like dried tears etched into the grain. No amount of scrubbing could remove these marks. Strangely, Celia felt no fear, just an odd mixture of sorrow and reverence, as though the floor itself bore witness to the tragedy. Across the Philippines, stories akin to the house that cries in the night are woven into local lore. A tragedy occurs, murder, betrayal, injustice, and the victim's spirits linger, searching for resolution. In many accounts, a key aspect is the interplay between Catholicism, with its doctrines of purgatory and intercession of saints, and pre-colonial animistic beliefs, which hold that spirits of the dead remain in close proximity to the living. This cultural tapestry informs how communities respond. Ghosts aren't always viewed as malevolent. Rather, they can be pitiful and in need of help. The phenomenon of nightly cries, flickering lights, and footsteps in empty corridors is often interpreted as a plea for assistance. "Help us," the ghosts seem to say. "Help us find rest." Batangas itself has a deep history, dating back to the Spanish colonial era. Countless battles, uprisings, and tragedies left spiritual imprints across the region. There are tales of undead Spanish friars, of guerrilla soldiers haunting old tunnels, of grieving mothers in remote barrios. In this broader context, the haunting of a single house takes its place in a grand continuum of restless spirits, a reminder that the land itself is saturated with stories of pain and resilience. The haunting in Nasugbu speaks to the fragility of collective memory. Communities often try to bury uncomfortable truths, but those truths have a way of resurfacing, demanding acknowledgement. Ghost stories, in this sense, function as cautionary tales. They underscore the crimes left unaddressed, morally or legally, can reverberate through time, manifesting as spectral echoes. True to her plan, Eliza compiled a detailed account of the murders and subsequent haunting. She wrote a concise narrative that included testimonies from neighbors, notes from the municipal archives, and quotes from Father Gerardo. She even included anonymized confessions of those who had heard or seen something suspicious on the night of the crime. With the help of local historians, she uploaded the document to a community blog and social media pages dedicated to local history. The reaction was swift and polarized. Some praised Eliza for bravely bringing closure to a dark chapter in Nasabu's history. Others criticized her for stirring up the past and risking the peace of the community. More than a few readers reached out, claiming they had pieces of information to add. Hints of conspiracies, half-remembered sightings of Corazon, and unconfirmed rumors of bribed officials swirled around the story. In short, the digital platform became an echo chamber for the unresolved tensions. Strangely enough, the story garnered a small international following. True crime aficionados and paranormal enthusiasts from abroad latched onto The House That Cries in the Night. They asked for translations, background data, and follow-up reports. Some even inquired about traveling to Nasubu to see the haunted house for themselves. The Martinez family, however, declined all requests for on-site visits. They didn't want their home to become a spectacle. As the story spread, the haunting within the house seemed to recede further, as though each public acknowledgement somehow appeased Marita and Jennifer's restless spirits. Several weeks passed without any nocturnal sobs or unexplained flickering light. The family finally found some semblance of normalcy. Reuben at his new construction job, Celia planning a small sari-sari store, Joseph focusing on basketball, and Eliza preparing for college. Then one day, a stranger showed up at the gate, a tall woman, possibly in her late 40s, with short hair sprinkled with grey. She wore oversized sunglasses and a guarded expression. Celia answered the door, her heart pounding.
"Yes? May I help you?"
The stranger took off her sunglasses. "I heard about the prayers you've been holding for the dead," she said quietly. I used to know the family who lived here." She introduced herself only as Rowena, but Celia had an inkling that this might be a friend or relative of Corazon. Rowena confessed she was related to Corazon by blood, but they had been estranged for years. She had come after reading the online account, wanting to see if the stories of the haunting were true. "Corazon always insisted she didn't act alone," Rowena said, trembling. "I don't know who else was involved, but it wasn't just about money. There were deeper grudges, something about an old family feud." Rowena's voice cracked. She seemed torn between loyalty to her kin and the crushing knowledge of a heinous crime. Celia offered her water and invited her to sit, but Rowena declined. She was too restless. "I just wanted you to know that if Marita and Jennifer are still here, maybe they should know that not everyone is silent. Some of us regret what happened, even if we weren't directly involved." As Rowena spoke, a gentle breeze rustled the leaves in the otherwise still afternoon. A subtle aroma of flowers drifted by, though there were no blossoms nearby. Rowena paused, tears streaming down her face. "I think they heard me," she whispered. Then she left as abruptly as she had come. Celia felt shaken, yet strangely hopeful. Another layer of the truth had been revealed, confirming that the crime was more complicated than the official record indicated. Perhaps the spirits had needed this confession, however incomplete, to move one step closer to rest. The Martinez family decided to hold one final night of prayer. Not a formal novena, but a heartfelt litany of closure. They invited anyone in the community who wished to join. Candles were lit in the living room, forming a soft glow that reminded everyone of the luminous warmth Marita and Jennifer had embodied in life. Celia led the opening prayer, followed by a communal recitation of the rosary. Then, one by one, people spoke. Some offered apologies for their silence. Others shared fond memories of Marita's cooking or Jennifer's vivacious laughter. As the last candle burned low, a hush fell upon the gathering. In that hush, there was a profound sense of release, as though an invisible chain had snapped, freeing the souls bound by the tragedy. After that night, the house felt different, as if someone had thrown open a window to let in fresh air after years of stagnation. Neighbors commented that they no longer felt uneasy walking past. The Martinez family slept without interruption from eerie sounds. Even the dog next door seemed calmer, rarely barking late into the night. Although the presence of Marita and Jennifer didn't vanish entirely, it transformed from a haunting into something gentler, like the memory of dear friends who still watch over a place they once loved. Eliza sometimes felt a slight warmth in the hallway, or caught a fleeting glimpse of a shadow in the kitchen, but instead of fear, she felt comfort. These were not tortured spirits anymore. They were guardians, perhaps, or simply echoes of lives that had been cut short but not forgotten. Years have passed since the Martinez family's intervention. They still reside in the same home. Celia's little Sari Sari store has become a local fixture, offering household staples and a friendly smile. Joseph made it into a college basketball team. Eliza, now studying journalism, occasionally writes about unsolved crimes, often referencing her personal experience with the house that cries in the night. Reuben, who once considered himself too pragmatic for ghost stories, has become a staunch advocate for community engagement. He attends town hall meetings, pushing for better neighborhood watch programs and encouraging people to speak out when they witness wrongdoing. He sometimes says, "If only people had come together back then, two lives might have been saved." The story of Marita and Jennifer spread through online platforms, has resonated far beyond Dasukbu. Their plight has become a cautionary tale about the risks of silence and the need for communal responsibility. It has also served as a reminder that justice is not merely a legal concept, but an ongoing moral pursuit. People continue to comment on blogs and social media posts, sharing how the story moved them to stand up against injustices in their own communities. What does it mean to be haunted? Some might say it's about spectral apparitions and eerie noises in the night, but perhaps the deeper hauntings in this world stem from unhealed wounds and untold stories. Marita and Jennifer became ghosts not just because they were murdered, but because society allowed their killer to slip away through legal technicalities. Their cries at night were the echoes of a moral imbalance, a communal failure to protect the vulnerable. Once that imbalance was addressed through confessions, prayers, and a collective vow never to let such a crime go ignored again, the haunting eased. It's a stark illustration that the dead, if indeed they remain among us, do so not only to scare, but also to teach. They beckon us toward empathy, accountability, and the healing power of truth. As you step away from this story, consider the lessons woven into the narrative. The tragedies we bury have a habit of resurfacing, sometimes as ghostly phenomena, other times as quiet regret in our hearts. In the Philippines and beyond, the line between life and afterlife is a thread sewn into cultural consciousness. We hold on to the idea that the dead might still walk beside us, longing for recent conviction. The celebrations of Christmas start today at 6 o'clock. The Korean neighborhood and friends and family, whether you believe in ghosts, literally or not, There's no denying the emotional truth they represent. The house that cries in the night is not just a chilling anecdote. It's a cautionary tale and a testament to the capacity for both betrayal and redemption within a community. When people come together by praying, speaking out, seeking truth, they can alter the legacy of a tragedy. It doesn't bring the departed back, but it can guide their spirits and ours toward a semblance of peace. If I were to rate the house that cries in the night purely on its chilling atmosphere, moral complexity, and the depth of cultural resonance it carries, I would give it 4 out of 5 stars. It's a potent blend of sorrow and the supernatural, mingling the familiar comforts of Filipino daily life with the dread that arises from unresolved injustice. The only shortcoming is the lingering mystery around the technicalities that freed the accused. An omission that keeps us yearning for answers. But perhaps that unrelenting desire for the full truth is exactly why the ghosts still whisper through the night. Thank you for journeying with me through this anonymous account in True Philippine Ghost Stories, Book 1. May the echoes of Marita and Jennifer's story linger, prompting each of us to listen more closely when cries pierce the night. And if we find ourselves in a house where shadows wander and walls seem to weep, let us remember that sometimes those cries are just a plea for the living to do what is right. If you think the world of fashion is all glamour and bright lights, you might want to think again. In our next episode, we'll delve into an anonymous account titled Model, also from True Philippine Ghost Stories, Book 1. Beauty, ambition, and hidden darkness converge under the spotlights, raising questions about the real cost of desire and the lines one crosses to stay on top. What secrets fester behind the perfect poise of a runway walk? And how does vanity entangle itself with nightmares that refuse to stay buried? Join us for episode 14, where we shine the stark light of curiosity on a stage that might be harboring more shadows than we ever imagined. Stay tuned, and remember, not all that glitters in the spotlight is truly divine. I'm Mark, and this has been True Philippine Ghost Stories Podcast. May you carry these lessons with you, and may the restless souls, wherever they wander, find the justice, truth, and peace they seek.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.